enough? That look nice? Friends, we've come to the beginning of the end, so to speak. This whole section from page 221 on to the end of the book has to do with proofs related to the revelation of the Bab. Baha'u'llah here presents the proofs of the Bab's mission, Bab's revelation. Up to this time, he's made some references to the Bab. He's made reference to all those doubts and questions which might impede a seeker from addressing himself to the question, is the revelation of the Bab a valid revelation from God? Now he begins to give direct proofs and evidences. In God Passes By, Shoghi Effendi makes reference that the Kitab-i-Badi of Baha'u'llah was the book that he wrote in defense of his own revelation in the same manner or parallel to the way he had written the Igan in the defense of the Bab's revelation. So there's some connection between these two books. Kitab-i-Badi has not been widely published even in the original language. We'll eventually know something more about it, but it's in particular, it's proofs and things addressed to the Babis. So it has a lot to do with the Bab's writings and with what the Babis were expecting from a new manifestation. But since we're not generally familiar with those details, it wouldn't be as interesting to us. However, there's something of the flavor of it in a large section of Epistle to the Son of the Wolf. And this is a book that I hope we can have a chance to study within the next few months, to start a study of that. Now, what then is the emphasis that Baha'u'llah places in this section of the book? We have him referring first to the proof of the acceptance by a number of divines and men of learning of the Bab's revelation, contrary to what's happened in past revelations, when really no one of any account in the eyes of society embraced the faith of God at the inception. He talks about Mullah Hussein, Sayyid Yahya, and some others. We'll be reading about them. Then he refers to the sacrifice of such men. There's a reference which leads us to have some understanding of the position and sacrifice of the Imam Hussein, the third of the Shia Imams. And he caps off this argument with the stating that the sign of truth and falsehood is that the believer who says he believes should wish for death. We'll be looking at that. Also then he tells us about revelation of an epistle to the divines of every city in Iran, in Persia at that time. He refers to the constancy and steadfastness of the Bab in proclaiming his faith. He then cites passages where he prophesies, where the Bab has prophesied his own martyrdom, and cites that as a proof. He also states that his ascendancy he accomplished unaided and alone. And this is a very interesting passage where Baha'u'llah relates that all scriptures and the mysteries of all scriptures have been condensed into the Kitab-i-Igan. Then there's a section from page 237 to 248. It contains references to various Islamic traditions. It talks about how the annulment of different rules and customs and habits have traditionally been a source or cause of denial of acceptance of a new messenger from God. He refers to the object of every revelation being the transformation of mankind. And then he cites some very specific traditions. After that, we come to a two-page entreaty to the people of the Bayan. Baha'u'llah directly supplicates them, calls on them, entreats them to respond correctly to the revelation. He makes reference to his own retirement to Kurdistan. By that is also a way of dating the book, because obviously it's written after he's returned from that exile. He expresses his own yearning for martyrdom in the path of the primal point. Refers to how the year of the Bab's coming was prophesied. How he embodies four signs from four prophets. And finally ends the Agon with a discussion of the twofold language of the manifestations. That brings us up to page 256. So we're back to 221, the beginning of proofs related to the revelation of the Bab. Did we cover 220 last week, this last paragraph? I think we ran out of time. I'm not sure if I got to that or not. We read it out. Did you notice this about the designation of prophets endowed with constancy? Because you'll see this term in other places in the Baha'i writings. What is a prophet endowed with constancy? What does it mean? How do we distinguish them from other prophets? He brings his own book, his own laws. Now, the lesser prophets of the house of Israel also brought a book in a sense that they prophesied and gave teachings. Are they prophets endowed with constancy? We're told that they aren't, because they didn't bring a book of laws. In a sense, the book, in that sense here, although their books are also called books, they're not books of laws. They don't set forth a new dispensation in that sense. They appear within the shadow of a previous dispensation and have performed a function within, say, the Mosaic dispensation, that of Moses, of a number of prophets that appeared, the Israelitish king prophets, and a special role. Now,
can you find it out from the original that you know what is meant by book? That is this book of law? Or it's just an interpretation?
I think you can see, simply because the content of the books of the lesser prophets, they don't change anything. They don't introduce questions of law at all. So we have Moses as a lawgiver, and we have Christ then referring and making certain changes in the law system of Moses. And you have Muhammad again making changes.
That's not the point. Do we see it in the world?
Does it say here? No, I can't. I've never seen it, except that's the fact that you have by comparing this passage with some answered questions, where he mentions greater and lesser prophets, and he talks about the greater prophets having a book and bringing laws, and the lesser prophets elaborating and falling within that sphere. So, endowed with constancy in that sense seems to mean this. I don't know if I have another reference to that in my notes or not. We had a reference to it a few pages ago in the last class. Also referred to on page 216. That's all we have here. You have to refer to some answer questions for more details. So on page 221, and this, by the way, was extracted from the Gan by Shoghi Effendi and included down to the bottom of the next page as a part of one of the extracts that he selected for the gleanings. One of those passages, the significance of which he felt should be included in gleanings from the writings of Baha'u'llah. Amongst the proofs demonstrating the truth of this revelation is this, that in every age and dispensation, whenever the invisible essence was revealed in the person of his manifestation, certain souls, obscure and detached from all worldly entanglements, would seek illumination from the sun of prophethood and moon of divine guidance and would attain unto the divine presence. For this reason, the divines of the age and those possessed of wealth would scorn and scoff at these people, even as he hath revealed concerning them that erred. And then he quotes from the Quran, "Then said the chiefs of his people who believed not, we see in thee but a man like ourselves, and we see not any who have followed thee except our meanest ones of hasty judgment. Nor see we any excellence in you above ourselves. Nay, we deem you liars." They cavilled at those holy manifestations and protested, saying, "None hath followed you except the abject amongst us, those who are worthy of no attention." You have another instance of Baha'u'llah citing the Quran in Arabic and then interpreting it in Persian. So it seems to be repeating the same thing, but it's because of the two languages. Their aim was to show that no one amongst the learned, the wealthy, and the renowned believed in them. By this and similar proofs, they sought to demonstrate the falsity that speaketh not but the truth. The falsity of him that speaketh not but the truth. In this most resplendent dispensation, however, this most mighty sovereignty, a number of illumined divines and men of consummate learning, of doctors of mature wisdom, have attained unto his court, drink the cup of his divine presence, and been invested with the honor of his most excellent favor. They have renounced for the sake of the beloved the world and all that is therein. We will mention the names of some of them, that perchance it may strengthen the faint-hearted and encourage the timorous. Among them was Mullah Hussein, who became the recipient of the effulgent glory of the Sun of Divine Revelation. Do we all know who Mullah Hussein is? I think if you've been reading history and you know that Mullah Hussein was the Bab ul-Bab, the first believer to accept the Bab in his revelation, and the first letter of the living. Baha'u'llah says something very powerful here. He says, but for him, Mullah Hussein, God would not have been established upon the seat of his mercy, nor ascended the throne of eternal glory. Among them also was Sayyid Yahya, that unique and peerless figure of his age. Now who is this, Sayyid Yahya? Rahid. Sayyid Yahya al-Arabi. Let's see, some notes here. Shoghi Effendi refers to the, in the translation here, he indents, as you see, a list of the names instead of putting them out in full in larger text. So we have Mullah Muhammad Ali Zanjani, Mulla Ali Bastami, Mulla Saidi Barfiroshi, Mulla Nematullah Mazandarani, Mulla Yusuf Ardabili, Mulla Mehdi Khoi, Sir Hosseini Torshizi, Mulla Mehdi Kandi, Mulla Baqir, Mulla Abdul Khaliq Yazdi, and Mulla Ali Faraghani. It's a lot of pronunciation, but I think that it's good to repeat their names here. These people have given their lives for the cause of God. We're not going to skip over them because they're Persian names and say, well, you see who's there. I think it's the challenge of the Westerners and the Easterners too to pronounce these names and try to become familiar with them and not see them as a whole lot of mullahs and I don't know what the rest of the name means. With regard to Mullah Hossein, you know how they study the Dornbergers in the West, they say, they'll be reading along and then they say, and then, what's his name, went out of the house and met, what's his name, and then, if you're listening, you know, it's pretty hard to follow the story. And later on when you want to try to figure something out, since you never read what's his name's name, you don't know that it's the same one now is going somewhere else, you know. Gradually you get the idea, ah, this is Sayyid, the guy is Sayyid, and then there's Sayyid here and Sayyid there, how can he be two places at once? Ah, and then you find out it's not his name, that's a title that a lot of people have, very popular first name. Gradually you separate the trees in the forest here. Alright, well, now Shoghi Effendi tells us in God Passes By something more about Mullah Hossein. He summarizes the references in the writings to his position. He says, the first letter of the living, surnamed the Babul Bab, the gate of the gate, designated as the primal mirror, on whom eulogies, prayers, and visiting tablets to a number equivalent to thrice the volume of the Quran had been lavished by the pen of the Bab. My goodness. Referred to in these eulogies as the beloved of my heart, the dust of whose grave that same pen had declared was so potent as to cheer the sorrowful and heal the sick. Now this is a reference to 70 kilometers around his resting place having the effects of this, the dust of that area having these effects. Whom the creatures raised in the beginning and in the end of the Babi dispensation envy and will continue to envy till the day of judgment. To whom Sayyid Qasim had paid such tribute that his disciples suspected that the recipient of such praise might well be the promised one himself. So references in God Passes By, page 50. You'll also find numerous references in the Dornbergers, of course, to the heroic deeds and acts of Mullah Hossein. And a tablet in the tablets of Baha'u'llah where he talks about the station of the disciples of the Bab and of his own disciples. He says that some of them are the return of figures of the past. And he says, if you would but accept that this Mullah Hossein is the return of Muhammad, of the spirit of Muhammad. Now he has Muhammad returning here in the person of Mullah Hossein to be the disciple of the Bab. That should tell us something about the Bab. The Bab has been called by Baha'u'llah the king of the messengers of God, the monarch of God's prophets. So this also gives us an idea, though the prophets are all the same, in the sense that we are all the same, we are all human beings, but some of us are doing things that others aren't doing. And among the prophets of God, some of them have a function and a role that others don't have. They may have all gone to the same university, but not everybody can be president at once. And this is the way the world is. Each of the creatures has a function. And some of the function is hierarchical in character, and in the relationships between these things, the order of proper order of things are unfolded. Sayyid Yahya is the second name that Baha'u'llah chooses to mention here, and he calls him that unique and peerless figure of his age. God passes by, he also refers to him. He's said Yahya Darabi, surnamed Vahid. He was a distinguished Muslim divine in the court of the Shah. The Shah, as you recall, when the Bab declared his mission and the rumors were coming from Shiraz about his greatness, sent who he thought to be the most learned of all of the divines and priests of the age, who was in the capital, as his personal emissary to go and get to the bottom of this thing. And Sayyid Yahya came with all of his pride and all of his powers, because he was a very brilliant man, and he had the three, you recall, three successive interviews with the Bab until he was completely won over, even to the point that he didn't bother to go back and report to the Shah. He sent him a letter and said, I'm here, I'm giving my life, I'm going to serve the Bab, he's the one. There was no mistaking this. He was eventually martyred at Nehriz on the 29th of June, 1850. Now, to see how close, just a few days before the martyrdom of the Bab, just 10 days actually before the execution of the Bab. You should see the Dawnbreakers, page 173, particularly about him. And also God Passes By, pages 11 and 12, and 42 to 44, which describe the Nehriz upheaval. The next name on the list is Mullah Muhammad Ali Zanjani, and this is another famous advocate of the cause. He was martyred together with 1,800 fellow disciples in the upheaval of Zanjan, also in 1850. And the story of that you will find in God Passes By, page 44 and page 50, and also chapter 24 of the Dawnbreakers. If you want to make notes on this list, then you'll have it here, so the next time you see it, you'll know who some of these people are, in case you don't already. Mullah Ali Bastami, energetic and audacious, one of the letters of the living, the first to leave the house of God, of Shiraz in other words, and the first to suffer for his sake. Excommunicated, chained, disgraced, imprisonment, and in all probability done to death. Now there's been some research that found that he was eventually carried to Baghdad and perhaps to Constantinople in the end before he died. God Passes By, page 10, and the Dawnbreakers, page 89, make reference to him. And Mullah Saeed Barfirushi is, according to Nabil's narrative, one of those who fought at Sheikh Tavarsi. And Mullah Yusuf Ardabili is one of the 18 letters of the living. You see the Dawnbreakers mentions him two or three places. Mullah Mehdi Khoi is also one of the letters of the living. Sayyid Hosseini Torshizi is one of the seven martyrs of Tehran. And he was a former mujtahid. He's a high-ranking clergyman. See Dawnbreakers 455, 456. Mullah Mehdi Kandi, we don't know much about Kandi. We don't know much about him. He was martyred at Sheikh Tavarsi. Mullah Baqir was another one of the letters of the living, who was from Tabriz. Mullah Abdul Khalik Yazdi was a Sheikhi, divine, and the author of numerous works. He's been mentioned in Nabil's narrative as well. Mullah Ali Baraghani is a paternal uncle of Tahire, a prominent Sheikhi divine renowned for his zealous devotions. And others, he says, well nigh 400 in number, whose names are all inscribed upon the guarded tablet of God. But they're not here to read tonight, no. Do we have the guarded tablet of God? Does anyone have the guarded tablet of God? No, I think it's a reference to...
What did you say about
I didn't say anything about it because we don't know anything about him. That's one of them that even the Persian annotators hadn't come up with anything about him. I'm sure there's something to know. If anybody wants to do some research to find out more about him, it would be good. Nematullahi Mazandarani. Does anybody know? Just how do you spell it? Letter of the, these was one of the letters of the living. The guarded tablet is understood generally to be a reference to the knowledge of God. All these, Baha'u'llah continues, all these were guided by the light of that Sun of Divine Revelation, confessed and acknowledged his truth. Such was their faith that most of them renounced their substance and kindred, and cleave to the good pleasure of the All-Glorious. They laid down their lives for their well-beloved and surrendered their all in his path. Their breasts were made targets for the darts of the enemies, and their heads adorned the spears of the infidel. No land remained which did not drink the blood of these embodiments of detachment, and no sword that did not bruise their necks. Their deeds alone testify to the truth of their words. Doth not the testimony of these holy souls who have so gloriously risen to offer up their lives for their beloved, that the whole world marveled at the manner of their sacrifice, suffice the people of this day? Is it not sufficient witness against the faithlessness of those who for a trifle betrayed their faith, who bartered away immortality for that which perisheth, who gave up the kosar of the divine presence for salty springs, and whose one aim in life is to usurp the property of others? Even as thou dost witness how all of them have busied themselves with the vanities of the world and have strayed far from him who is the Lord, the Most High. I understand Baha'u'llah has made a reference to the Shias, particularly the clergy. He said that by the time of the coming of the Bab, they had completely changed from being religious in character to being commercial in character. The whole thrust of their activity was business. Be fair, is the testimony of those acceptable and worthy of attention, whose deeds agree with their words, whose outward behavior conforms with their inner life? The mind is bewildered at their deeds, and the soul marvelous at their fortitude and bodily endurance. For is the testimony of these faithless souls who breathe not but the breath of selfish desire and who lie imprisoned in the cage of their idle fancies acceptable? Like the bats of darkness, they lift not their heads from their couch, except to pursue the transient things of the world, and find no rest by night except as they labor to advance the aims of their sordid life. Immersed in their selfish schemes, they are oblivious of the divine decree. In the daytime, they strive with all their soul after worldly benefits, and in the night season, their sole occupation is to gratify their carnal desires. By what law or standard could men be justified in cleaving to the denials of such petty-minded souls and in ignoring the faith of them that have renounced for the sake of the good pleasure of God their life and substance, their fame and renown, their reputation and honor? Several times this evening we've seen this reference to the divine presence. And you remember we have read a section of the Igan where the various levels of revelation have been discussed. 3 degrees or stages of divine revelation. And you'll find this back on page 138 through 142. And he talks about the meaning of the verse attainment unto the divine presence. And if he says, if it means by that divine presence attaining to the revelation in the day of revelation, does it mean the universal revelation It is no, because this is always present, and this divine presence is promised for the day of resurrection. Does it refer to the what he calls the specific revelation of God, which seems to be a revelation of God unto himself in his own Godhead? He says if it's that, nobody can attain to it anyway, so that's out. And then he describes a secondary revelation, and he says this is applicable to these universal manifestations of God, and to know them, to see them, to recognize them is to know and recognize and see God himself. Although they themselves deny that they are the essence of God, they say God is something else other than them. But for humankind, there is no access to the divine except through these manifestations. That is the most potent means for us to know God, is to see him in the person of the manifestations of God. And even to that degree, we saw these marvelous passages where at times they speak in the voice of humility and selflessness, in that they are nothing but men like the rest of us. And yet again, at other times they say, "Verily, verily, I am God." And they clearly proclaim from their person. And Baha'u'llah says the meaning of this is that they are so self-effaced in their own embodiment of the divine that God speaks from them in the first person. He speaks to us. He looks at us through their eyes. He speaks to us with their mouths. And this is the day of God. And this is that great bounty that the human race has attained to in this time. And we have these verses revealed from the lips of Baha'u'llah to inspire and generate spiritual development for 500,000 years with the successive appearance of other divine messengers who will add to it and bring laws suited for the time they live in, other prophets endowed with constancy, but under his spiritual influence and shadow. You're asking, is that so? No, the doctrine here says that they all are capable of doing that. But Baha'u'llah is more predominant in his revelation than any of the previous ones. Verily, I and the Father are one, Christ said, for example. There are statements which... No, the Father in the New Testament doesn't refer to Baha'u'llah, it refers to God the Essence. In the Old Testament, there's a reference to Everlasting Father, and that's confirmed as referring to Baha'u'llah. It's a prophecy about a prophetic figure who would come with the title Everlasting Father. But we shouldn't confuse Father in the New Testament with the role of Baha'u'llah as the Father has come. It refers to the Old Testament, because the station of the Father in the New Testament is really the station of the essence of God, the unseen essence in relation to Christ, the manifestation of God. This is the way I understand it from things that I've read. I presume we have some letters on that too. I think there it's confirmed. It's very strong in Pilgrim Notes, because the Baha'is were saying these things, and Jogi Gandhi would say, no, that's blasphemous to see the Father in the New Testament as being Baha'u'llah. Also, this question of the voices of the manifestations, the different states that they speak forth from, we've discussed at length that teaching also, and it shows that each of them is capable of speaking from all these different stations, from divinity down to servitude, and still they're true, and that the way to resolve the understanding of all these diverse and apparently contradictory statements is this passage in the Agon, which tells you that all these conditions are possible to them, and at the same time they remain divine manifestations of God. Kosar, you know, means this river in paradise. been referred to in the Quran, and Baha'u'llah uses it in his writings. So there's another one. What's the other river? Zamzam. Salsabil is the one he leaves in English. He leaves Kosar and Salsabil oftentimes in English. Kosar is literally abundance, a river in paradise whence all other rivers derive their source. Often in the writings of Baha'u'llah, this term has been translated as a heavenly river or a living fountain, and similar phrases. For example, in the long obligatory prayer, make my prayer, O my Lord, a fountain of living waters, a kosar of living waters. According to the tradition of the Prophet, this river wherein his Lord promised him abundant good is sweeter than honey, whiter than milk, cooler than snow, and smoother than cream. Its banks are of chrysolites, and the vessels to drink thereout of silver, and those who drink of it shall never thirst. These four rivers in other traditions are referred to as rivers flowing from out of the throne of God. In the center of paradise you have the throne, and then you have four rivers flowing in four directions. And one refers to water, and one refers to, I think, is honey, and another to wine, and another to milk. And Mirza Abul Fazl has interpreted these as the characteristic divisions of the holy writings of Baha'u'llah. Milk being like laws and the structural teachings, administrative teachings, the society organizing principles, like milk helps to order the bones in your body and so on. Wine, the teachings, the mystic teachings in a sense that intoxicate the heart. Water, the life-giving waters of knowledge of God, understanding, vision, and honey, and prayers and meditations and the sweetness of divine communion. That may be not exactly all the words fitting with each one, but you get the general idea that these prophecies have some spiritual significance rather than being a geographical description of something on high. Now, maybe you'll also see it there, I don't know. We'll have to see. At least you'll know what it means if you see it and have some idea to interpret it in those terms. Do you have any comments or questions?
Where were you reading from?
I was reading a footnote from Sale's translation of the Quran. Page 502. Of the 1870 edition. Just run down the corner and find one. Now, at the bottom of 225, Baha'u'llah refers to the Prince of Martyrs. This is footnoted to tell us that this is the Imam Hussein, the third Imam, son of the Imam Ali and of Fatima, the daughter of the Prophet Muhammad. One of two sons who were Imams. Hassan was first and then Hussein. Were not the happenings of the life of the Prince of Martyrs regarded as the greatest of all events, as the supreme evidence of his truth? Did not the people of old declare those happenings to be unprecedented? Did they not maintain that no manifestation of truth hath ever evinced such constancy, such conspicuous glory? And yet that episode of his life, commencing as it did in the morning, was brought to close by the middle of the same day. Whereas these holy lights have for 18 years heroically endured the showers of afflictions which from every side have rained upon them. With what love, what devotion, what exaltation and holy rapture they sacrificed their lives in the path of the All-Glorious. To the truth of this, all witness, And yet how can they belittle this revelation? Hath any age witnessed such momentous happenings? If these companions be not the true strivers after God, who else could be called by this name? Have these companions been seekers after power or glory? Have they ever yearned for riches? Have they cherished any desire except the good pleasure of God? If these companions, with all their marvelous testimonies and wondrous works, be false, who then is worthy to claim for himself the truth? I swear by God, their very deeds are a sufficient testimony and an irrefutable proof unto all the peoples of the earth, were men to ponder in their hearts the mysteries of divine revelation. And they who act unjustly shall soon know what lot awaiteth them. He quotes from the Quran. No notes on Mullah, on Imam Hussein here, all right. This is a very moving episode in the history of Islam, where, surrounded by the enemies, he and his family, who were really unarmed, were attacked and slaughtered, their heads cut off and carried on spears to the place of the caliphs of Islam. Now, it must have been quite a scene. The usurpers of the authority of Muhammad, in the person of the Umayyad caliphs, holding court and having the heads of the family of Muhammad brought into their presence. What a contradiction in intent and spirit. Furthermore, the sign of truth and falsehood is designated and appointed in the book. By this, now he's bringing another proof, which we mentioned earlier. By this divinely appointed touchstone, the claims and pretensions of all men must needs be assayed, so that the truthful may be known and distinguished from the impostor. This touchstone is no other than this verse: wish for death if ye be men of truth. Consider these martyrs of unquestionable sincerity, to whose truthfulness testifieth the explicit text of the book, and all of whom, as thou hast witnessed, have sacrificed their life, their substance, their wives, their children, their all, and ascended unto the loftiest chambers of paradise. Is it fair to reject the testimony of these detached and exalted beings to the truth of this preeminent and glorious revelation, and to regard as acceptable the denunciations which have been uttered against this resplendent light by this faithless people, who for gold have forsaken their faith, and who for the sake of leadership have repudiated him who was the first leader of all mankind? This, although their character is now revealed unto all people who have recognized them as those who will in no wise relinquish one jot or one tittle of their temporal authority for the sake of God's holy faith, how much less their life, their substance, and the like. Behold how the divine touchstone hath, according to the explicit text of the book, separated and distinguished the true from the false. Notwithstanding, they are still oblivious of this truth, and in the sleep of heedlessness are pursuing the vanities of the world, and are occupied with thoughts of vain and earthly leadership. Another class last week we had tittle. We have jots and tittles here. One jot or one tittle. What were jots and tittles again? The dots above I's and the crosses on T's, not particularly He says, Baha'u'llah is saying they won't relinquish even a jot or a tittle, not anything else, much less their substance and their lives. But they had temporal authority. This is what they were seeking. And they're still occupied with the same game. The clergy of Shia Islam at the present time. Now, this is very interesting. Baha'u'llah now quotes a hidden word. Doesn't tell you it's a hidden word, but suddenly a hidden word appears here. So, one presumes this has been revealed before, but perhaps from what we know, they were fairly close in their revelation. O son of man, many a day hath passed over thee, whilst thou hast busied thyself with thy fancies and idle imaginings. How long art thou to slumber on thy bed? Lift up thine head from slumber, for the sun hath risen to the zenith. Haply it may shine upon thee with the light of beauty. Fancies and idle imaginings busying themselves is like being asleep on a couch. Being in a state of mesmerized state of uselessness. Maybe the light of beauty will shine on you. Now we're trying to get our heads out of the grave, and we're supposed to be resurrected. That is, we are called by the trumpet blast of Baha'u'llah's knowledge to rise up out of the graves of our idle fancies, our vain imaginings, our worthless passions, to come up out of that state of stupor and sleep and fly in the heaven of faith and certitude, and soar in the sunlight of the beauty of God, the glory of God. It says all mankind will be resurrected in this day of judgment. Now you are the first flyers, the first floaters maybe. I don't know how whether we're floaters or flyers, but anyway, we're trying to absorb some of the heat and light of the Sun of Truth and call others out of their graves, repeat the trumpet blast ourselves in our teaching work, try to reach to the hearts of people and awaken them, let the veils be split asunder so that they can see out and see something real instead of circling around their own desires and their own imaginings and their own personal view of life. People say that they want to, they're not ready for religion, they have a life of their own to lead and to live. And of course, this just encompasses them with more and more veils and more difficulties. Or they want to find themselves before they deal with religion. And the Master says, without light you see nothing. You can't look into yourself without the influence of prayer and the holy teachings. That's what gives us insight to see ourselves. Sometimes we want to solve our problems without prayer and without recourse to the divine teachings. He says, well, that's not a problem for God. This is my problem. I'll work this one out myself. And we find that we're not working it out, it's working us out, you know. It's exhausting us in our spiritual capacity. So then we turn to him and we present him with our problems and we rely on him, we lean on the Lord. Abdu Baha says that's what prayer is about, is leaning on the Lord. It's a nice image, isn't it? To be able to say, when you're exhausted and you can't walk, you just lean on the Master or whatever. He says he will carry you even if you can't walk. But you have to recognize your own incapacity. It seems we have to be taught that. And he has lots of lessons for them, there's lots of ways that he has of showing us these things. And he wastes no time, and he finds the best method to illumine us with regard to our own insufficiency and lack of capacity and inability and stupidity and vileness and all the rest of these things we find in ourselves. All of this is a mercy on his part. One of the hadith, he says, when God desires to show favor unto his servant, he reveals to him his faults. And we go around and saying, I don't know what's happened. God used to be so kind to me. Now everything seems to be going wrong. But that's his great favor. He's showing us our weaknesses and our shortcomings so that we will flee to him. If he really gives us a good look in the mirror, it's pretty horrible. The worst thing that we see, or suddenly we see that that's us. We have all the capacity for the worst of all possible things. And then we don't like to see that because that's not our image of ourselves. After all, I'm the image and likeness of God. How can I look like this when I look carefully? So, through a glass darkly, we see light. Then Baha'u'llah goes on. He's talked about these certain divines, certain outstanding spiritual leaders that have followed the Bab. And then he's condemned these other ones who are occupied with worldly affairs and interests, with temporal as in earthly authority, temporal authority. He says, let it be known, however, that none of these divines, these doctors and divines to whom we have referred, was invested with the rank and dignity of leadership. For well-known and influential leaders of religion who occupy the seats of authority and exercise the functions of leadership can in no wise bear allegiance to the revealer of truth, except whomsoever thy Lord willeth. But for a few, such things have never come to pass, and few of my servants are the thankful. Even as in this dispensation, not one amongst the renowned divines, in the grasp of whose authority were held the reins of the people, hath embraced the faith. Nay, they have striven against it with such animosity and determination that no ear hath heard and no eye hath seen the like. We read in the hidden word here about the light of beauty. I have a note on that. It says, compare this passage with the following words of Baha'u'llah, cited in a tablet in the Gleanings. He says, the revelations of thy matchless beauty have at all times been imprinted upon the realities of all things, visible and invisible. Let me read that again. Think, what in the world is Baha'u'llah talking about? The revelations of thy matchless beauty, addressing God, have at all times been imprinted upon the realities of all things, visible and invisible. So we are led to understand that the effects of revelation are flowing or are directed at every instant upon the realities of things. One of those realities, the primal mirror of those effulgences of revelation, is the human reality, the human soul. Baha'u'llah says it's a heavenly gem, mysterious entity, a divine energy, if you will, which is then further charged by the influence of this divine revelation. If it is not surrounded by mists and clouds which keep that light from reaching its inner reality. The misdeeds of men seem to produce these clouds around us. We want our own misdeeds, our own heedlessness, if you will, as he calls it, raflat, the heedlessness, the negligence of what we should really be occupied with if we were faithful to the covenant of God in the sense of seeking his presence and his purpose and aspiring to that character of spirituality which would have a profound influence on everything around us and on the progress of the cause. Always imprinted on our realities are these beautiful things, the truths of his kingdom, the divine mysteries and wisdoms of his being. Invisible? Well, I'm sure I couldn't give you any kind of assurance of an interpretation, but I understand it to be the spiritual world as well as, in other words, we have two worlds. We have the world of God and then we have the world of command, and out of that comes the worlds of creation. And the worlds of creation are divided into a whole stream of spiritual, infinite stream of spiritual realms and worlds, and then finally the outermost of those worlds is the physical world, a material, mortal world. So the visible world is the one we live in. It means that these truths are imprinted in nature as well as in everything that exists, because they're all embodiments of names, the names and attributes of God as archetypal forces which are woven together through the invention of God or the invention of man in some cases. And they manifest ideas, they manifest invisible things in outer forms. And then there are the realities behind those things, and they're also in the immediate stream. In fact, he says the influence, of course, of the manifestations there is greater than here. When the soul is there, how much more it will be influenced by the light streaming from the manifestation. We will have had this physical shell, and this duality of character that we have in this life will have been removed from us. And then we'll have witnessed the light directly. This seems to be the implications of it. I don't know. But it's worth meditating on. This is exciting. This is on page 63 of the Gleanings. Can read what's before it and what's after it as well. You'll find parallel passages to this. The question of the imprinting of forms or the appearance of the forms in other tablets of Baha'u'llah and also of the Master. For instance, he says, in the act of teaching, the star-like images of the kingdom are attracted to the mirror of the human heart. And then man is given a power to transform those images into inspirational words and acts and deeds of the highest character. There's something that guides him and orients him. And those things stream in the heart. Of course, particularly, we become more receptive when we're reading the words of God. We're reading the prayers and we're reading the words of God. We want to orient ourselves. We focus, if you will, on that projection of these divine truths, and then they become clear. And also it's as if we were tuning, like the radio. The beautiful music's on the radio all the time, and some other music too, but the beautiful music's on the radio, and you tune the radio, and then out comes the music. When it's not tuned, it's very unpleasant. In fact, it can be worse than not any music at all. But if you can get it tuned right, you get this really spiritual stereo, you know, that you can hear the intent of God. It's an orientation of the soul, it's a focusing in prayer, it's a learning how to turn to the manifestation of God, something that we do over and over again, so that we're doing it all the time, even during the day when we're not praying, yet we are becoming aware of his presence. Sometimes we get sweetness in our lives, a touch of it, something comes over us and we think, gosh, how sweet Baha'u'llah is, or how great the cause is, or look where I'm standing here in the middle of this mud puddle. in the shadow of the shrine of the Bob or something, whatever you happen to be doing, or with your pail and your wash water in it, walking around the seat of the House of Justice, whatever happens to be your function. All Baha'u'llah wants us to do is the best at what we've been given to do. Maybe you've heard Mr. Nakhchivani talking about if there's a broom in your hand, you should sweep with perfection. That's the point. Doesn't matter what we're doing. If you're filing letters, file to perfection. This is the health of the soul, is in the fullness with which we serve and act and work and teach and love each other. This is the means of an atmosphere in which the soul thrives, and then you see things after it takes a little while, like in a garden you plant seeds. Here in the Holy Land you have this atmosphere of the Baha'i community. You have tests which are like the opening of the furrows, and then Baha'u'llah throws these marvelous seeds, or he causes the seeds that he's already got in there to germinate and start blossoming inside us, and new perceptions, new understandings, new beauty in life, new excitement, new wonders. All of this is there just to come out under the influence of his teachings and this kind of service that you've come here to give, because whatever, what else are you here for? You're not going to get rich here. So you've already come here in sacrifice. You reap this harvest and you carry it back in the other world, and you do some transplants of these flowers and things in other hearts and souls. I think that the service of the friends in the World Center is gradually going to effect a great change in the Baha'i community around the world. Well, we're coming here now to the description of the Bab. He says, "The Bab, the Lord, the Most Exalted, may the life of all be a sacrifice unto him, hath specifically revealed an epistle unto the divines of every city, wherein he hath fully set forth the character of the denial and repudiation of each of them." How'd you like to get a letter from the Bab which describes to you your own innermost thoughts about how you denied him and repudiated him? "Wherefore take ye good heed, ye who are men of insight." I don't know how far they read the tablets that they got. By his references to their oppositions, he intended to invalidate the objections which the people of the Bayan might raise in the day of the manifestation of the Mostaghas, the day of the latter resurrection, claiming that whereas in the dispensation of the Bayan a number of divines have embraced the faith, in this latter revelation none of these have recognized his claim. His purpose was to warn the people lest, God forbid, they cling to such foolish thoughts and deprive themselves of the divine beauty. Yea, these divines to whom we have referred were mostly unrenowned, and by the grace of God they were all purged of earthly vanities and free from the trappings of leadership. Such is the bounty of God. To whom he will, he giveth it. Another proof and evidence of the truth of this revelation, which amongst all other proofs shineth as the sun, is the constancy of the eternal beauty in proclaiming the faith of God. Now he tells us a little bit about the Bab. Before we go on with that, let's discuss the Mostaghas. The meaning of Mostaghas is he who is invoked. He who is invoked. The numerical value of which has been assigned by the Bab as the limit of the time fixed for the advent of the promised manifestation. In other words, Baha'u'llah. Remember a reference from God Passes By. He says, during the Bab's confinement in the fortress of Chehrik, the Lohe Hurufat, the tablet of the letters, was revealed in honor of Dayan. A tablet which, however misconstrued at first as an exposition of the science of divination, was later recognized to have unraveled on the one hand the mystery of the Mostaghas, and to have abstrusely alluded on the other to the 19 years which must needs elapse between the declaration of the Bab and that of Baha'u'llah. God passes by, page 27. You'll see also, if you look in the Dawnbreakers, page 304 and 305, Nabil writes concerning Baha'u'llah's explanation of the mystery of the Mustaghas, which was revealed in answer to a request made of him while he was in Akka. Baha'u'llah adduced from the statements of the Bab irrefutable evidence proving that the appearance of the Man Yazhir Ruhullah, he whom God will make manifest, must needs occur no less than 19 years after the declaration of the Bab. The mystery of the Mustaghas had long baffled the most searching minds among the people of the Bayan and had proved an unsurmountable obstacle to their recognition of the Promised One. They calculated it in such a way that it was going to be 1,000 some years. So because of that interpretation, this was one of the veils that kept them from recognizing Baha'u'llah. They said, well, how can he be another manifestation? If we just had a manifestation, we would have another manifestation. They never heard of such a thing. And so this was one of the problems that they had, at least those that were not sincere in their searching. The Bab had himself in that tablet unraveled that mystery. No one, however, was able to understand the explanation which he had given. It was left to Baha'u'llah to unveil it to the eyes of all men. I hope that was clear. Mustaghas. You'll see references to it in different places in the writings. Ya Elah el Mustaghas is an invocation that's often used by the Baha'is in times of danger, or for divine assistance needed on the spot immediately, as in when you're in mortal danger through some temptation, you can use it too. Ya Allah al Mustaghas. In fact, you find if you can write this down and repeat it a few times, like say 19 times, it would be an interesting experience for you. The problem is we are always in immediate danger, but we don't realize in what a perilous state we are walking around. But we could use it for the more acute moments that we become aware of it. Ya Allah al Mustaghas. Sure, why not? How do we translate Ya Allah al Mustaghas? Oh God. Oh God who art invoked, or something like that.
Oh God of him, he who is invoked.
Right? By the time you say that 19 times, you might as well say the Ya Allah al-Mustaghas. Not so hard. I think one can always say these things in their own language, but if you learn a few things in the original tongue, there's a certain... All these tape recorders playing, I can't tell you what I want to tell you. There's a certain magic in the original languages. These are languages of revelation. The very sound of them has functionality, has spiritual functionality, and has its effects on the heart. The repetition of Allahu Akbar, besides its meaning, the very sound of it somehow resonates and combines and heals and refines and unites, and it has its meaning. And so these prayers, if you learn little prayers or phrases and things, I think you'll find repeating them, it helps you. Yes, well, he heard the master tell one of the believers that if he had troubles or had some decision to make, to turn to Akka and say Ya Allah al-Mustaghas 19 times and then take a decision. But it's a pilgrim note, but still, there are other tablets where it's suggested that these things be repeated in different ways. There's no, the one formula that we have fixed is the use of Allahu Akbar 95 times at once in each 24 hours. This is a law of the Kitab-i Aqdas, which will become binding on all of us in the future. Of course, nobody's going to enforce this like the fast or the obligatory prayer. It's up to the believer to adopt to do it. But it's not as if it were a law that were impossible to fulfill now. And both Shoghi Effendi and the House of Justice said those laws which are not in conflict with civil laws and others, the believers are welcome to embrace them already now and use them. But they shouldn't make a fuss about saying, do you say you're 95? Allahu Akbar, you know, why don't you say it? No, but it's there for us. Let us know it's there. Maybe if we use it a week or something, say, make ourselves a goal to use it for 5 days in a row and see what does that do now to human life? What's the effect of that on each 24 hours? We're beginning to know the effects of the obligatory prayers, how they act on us. This cyclic renewal of spiritual force in human lives that takes place through the use of them. The Baha'is, some people write and ask the House of Justice, well, I've heard of transcendental meditation and these other things to really become spiritual. Is it all right for Baha'i to do this? You know? The House of Justice has written back that the basic elements for spiritual growth are very simple in the faith. They are fasting and the use of obligatory prayer, serving the cause, teaching the cause. It's most two pillars of spiritual development, spiritual life, are fasting and obligatory prayer, just alone. We should trust that Baha'u'llah hasn't revealed something insufficient to make us spiritual. Our attitude towards it may be something that blocks its full effect, but eventually it's kind of the flood of this water is going to break through any kind of barriers that we've placed. You know? Hopefully it will wash out all of those things which are in us that shouldn't be in us, so that we can receive a flow of this kosar that is flowing on high. Abdu'l Baha says that divine inspiration, divine knowledge starts drop by drop in the human soul, and then it creates a little rivulet. And after this little rivulet broadens into a trickle and then a little stream and finally becomes a flowing river. And then a torrent of divine knowledge and inspiration comes to the soul of the one that steadfastly seeks after it. It increases till it's flowing and moving and stirring our beings to their depths. Why not? If we can at least aim that direction anyway. Some fruit ripens in the other after it comes off the tree. It said it will have the greater effects of this, of course, in the world to come. But we should aim high while we're here too, no harm. Instead of just walking through life thinking, well, that's for the really big Baha'is or fancy Baha'is or whatever Baha'is we think it should be, but not for me. Look at me, I'm not anything. How could I attain to these things? Well, you're human souls. Everybody's a human soul. And just because people get elected to different offices doesn't mean they necessarily have such gifts and graces. We all have to do what we're called to do in the cause. I remember reading some startling pilgrim notes from Maria Kahnum's time that she brought back to America. When she was here in the early days, before she married the Guardian, she said, Shoghi Effendi said, the rank and file of the believers are much more spiritual than the National Assembly members. Almost as if the guys that were elected were more of a political character than... We shouldn't think spirituality has something to do with the function of duties in the faith. It does and it should, but it doesn't necessarily. And it's certainly by no means limited there. And it may be easier to be close to God when you don't have to be an officer of a spiritual assembly or a member of a committee or some other thing. You know, you can devote yourself to teaching and studying the cause and so serving. My favorite function in the cause is to be an isolated pioneer where there's nobody else to do the work. So you just end up saying, Baha'u'llah, if it's not me, there's nobody else here right now. Please help me. And then if something happens, you feel, well, he's helped. But my goodness, it's getting hard in the world to find a place like that where you can go. You always have to share it with other pioneers now. I think the Soviet Union and China has plenty of places, though, so if you want to get yourselves ready for isolated splendor, service, free from administrative problems, at least till you get 9 believers, you could try that. I like this tremendous spiritual growth in becoming a part of the administrative services, too. You are a part of it now, serving here in whatever capacity you are. You know, you're in support of the administrative order and its supreme institution. When you go back, you'll have lots of opportunities, I'm sure, out in the world to add to those services. Well, I think this brings us to the close this evening. We'll take up again on 2:30 next week.